from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Daniel Yergin joins us in this next Forum Hour. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Prize, The Epic Quest for Oil, Money, and Power, which was made into a PBS series. He's also one of the world's foremost energy experts and author of a recently published book, The Quest, Energy, Security, and the Remaking of the Modern World. He joins us in studio after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of our forum program. Our guest this hour is Daniel Yergin, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Prize and chair of the IHS Cambridge Energy Research Associates. New York Times called Daniel Yergin America's most influential energy pundit, and he's widely recognized as a leading expert on energy policy and a leading analyst of world energy markets, especially petroleum. He's a recipient of the United States Energy Award for, quote, lifelong achievements in energy and the promotion of international understanding, end quote. His recently published book is called The Quest, Energy, Security, and Remaking of the Modern World. And he joins us in studio for the second Forum Hour. Glad to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you.
I guess I'd like to talk about the book, and so much in the book that there is to talk about. Because when you get into energy, as you say, it's almost, well, is it an inexhaustible topic, if not an inexhaustible resource? I'm interested, though, in getting your response, since we talked the last hour, about what the response ought to be by the United States or the Saudis to this recent turn of events with respect to Iran. And I was mentioning, actually, prompted by some remarks you made, I believe, on CNN about how the Saudis could actually drive the price of oil down and really affect the Iranian economy.
Right. Well, I think Iran is very vulnerable economically because of its growing population, its stagnant oil output, and also government spending that's truly out of control. But I think the Saudis would be cautious about trying to actually use the price politically, because a lot of unintended consequences. And like a lot of other countries, they themselves now, in the aftermath of the Arab Spring, need revenues. I mean, Saudi King in June put out a $131 billion program of social spending. So I think – but what it does point to is the tension and the ratcheting up of tension in the Gulf region, which has 60% of conventional world oil reserves, because they're – there's Iraq, there's Syria, there's Yemen, there's Bahrain, and there's Iran's nuclear program. So all of those things are already there. On top of it, you now have this, and it demonstrates the hostility that exists.
We also heard from Juan Cole about the threat that came out from Assad about just torching the whole area if any missile came into Syria, that sort of thing. I mean, it's just so volatile that when you talk about petroleum, and you know, you've been talking about it for years and talking about it with a great deal of wisdom, but when you talk about it, particularly in terms of the geopolitics of that region, everything is so volatile and so unpredictable that it makes one sort of hair stand up on end in terms of what you can expect.
Well, what I in the part of the quest where I discuss it, I say that there are three big threats to the region. One is Iran and its neighbors, and it's the relationship there. And the clock is ticking on the nuclear program. Something will happen. At the very least, it could lead to a nuclear arms race in the region, not good for stability. Secondly is the continuing questions of terrorism, and particularly Yemen as a failed state. And the third thing are the same factors that led to the Arab Spring, this youth bulge, this large population of young people without expectations that can be met, opportunities closed off, such a big part of the population. And that was what really was the engine of what became known as the Arab Spring.
And it's ongoing. I mean, it's a drama to a great extent that nobody can predict, even the most prescient among us. Right?
Well, I think that's true. I think if you went back, wound the clock back to January and asked the heads of all of the intelligence agencies in the region, were they available? And if you had their phone numbers and said, you know, is this going to happen? They would say, no, of course it's not going to happen. It can't happen. It was so striking to me as I was finishing the quest that these two events, both of which in a sense, unexpected, both of them with huge impact on energy in our world, one the Arab Spring and the other, of course, the nuclear accident at Fukushima on March 11th.
They both make their way into the book. And you also, I mean, before we go to contemporary stuff, you take us through a whole history. You pretty much unfurl for us a lot of the evolution of where we were and where we are today. And there are some really, I think, important points that that listeners can particularly relate to about well, the massive corporate mergers, first of all, really change things and change things enormously, transform the whole oil industry, as you point out in your book. But also, we're seeing a big game change now by the breakup of the Soviet Union.
You're right. The when I finished the prize, there was still a Soviet Union, and then it ceased to exist. And it opened up a whole part of the world, the Caspian, the Caucasus, Central Asia, and led to what I call the Caspian Derby, the great competition for influence to see who would dominate that part of the world and where would those oil resources that had not really been developed or connected to the world for many decades. Baku once had been, at one point, the largest source of oil at the beginning of the 20th century. That's the capital of Azerbaijan, but it all faded away. And you had these personalities who appeared on the scene who changed themselves from being Soviet men to being native sons and came to lead these countries.
And that's where really a lot of the new game is, as you describe it. But also, even notwithstanding all that resource that comes out of that part of the world and what may come out of the Middle East, one of the I guess the biggest flaps that's come about as a result of your book is this whole question of peak oil and whether or not peak oil is a reality.
Yeah, and it certainly is a flap.
Flap may be an euphemistic.
Yeah, euphemistic. It brings forth very strong emotions, and people hold views very deeply and express them with great vigor, I would say. The basic argument is that the world has reached a point where we're about halfway through our endowment of oil and we're on the downside. And people who hold it, you know, certainly feel very strongly about it. I do look at it with a historical view and see that we've been through periods before. Going back to the 1880s when the world was going to run out of oil, Woodrow Wilson said he was going to walk to church as president because the country was short of oil. World War II, and then many of your listeners will remember the 1970s when we fell off the oil mountain and it was all over, and world oil production's up about 30% since then. So just the analysis, and this is, it's not an emotional, you know, commitment one way or the other. It's just the analysis says there's plenty of oil resources left. It's not necessarily in the best parts of the world. There are a lot of risks that we've just been talking about. For instance, the Middle East, a lot of bad problems can ensue from it, but we're not going to run out tomorrow. It probably has a longer horizon, but so much depends upon what happens above ground.
There's also all the new technology that we can't even predict, I think you bring into the equation,
yeah,
don't you?
It is that the it's a very interesting problem because you see, for instance, the man who is a kind of considered the prophet of peak oil, M. King Hubbert. He was writing in the 1950s during a time of stagnant technology and just didn't envision the technology we have today. So he said U.S. would be producing 1.5 million barrels a day today. It's about 5.5 million. And we've just seen in the last few years kind of almost an explosion of new technology. Brazil, which went into the ethanol business in the 1970s because it didn't have any oil, is now slated because of its offshore oil to perhaps be double the output of Venezuela. We have tight oil in the United States. U.S. oil production's up 10%. And then we have this immense resource that people didn't focus on a decade ago, the oil sands in Canada.
What about that pipeline? I mean, we're still waiting for President Obama to come down one way or the other on that. Where do you stand on it?
Well, I think it's a sensible thing to do. That I think it's terrific for U.S. energy security, that you have a very large resource there. The output of the Canadian oil sands is equivalent to the output of Libya's exports prior to the Civil War. And I think I find Canadians get really upset because they have this – Americans seem to have the view that Canadians don't care about the environment and don't – and that it's the wild north, that they don't regulate. Canada's – this industry, like many other things in Canada, is very highly regulated.
Very environmental country. But I had Bill McKibben on when he did that protest in D.C. and yeah. He was saying essentially this is the death knell for Well, for the air we breathe. I mean,
yeah. Well, it's just I don't think that's correct, because in fact, if you look on a carbon basis, it's a very emotional issue, very inflammatory issue. People demonstrated in front of the White House. If you say how much more carbon comes out of a barrel of oil sands, and you look at it from the well all the way to the wheels, it's about 6% more. We use many barrels of oil in the United States that are also about 6% above the average barrel. So a lot of these numbers are thrown away, but it's become a huge symbolic target, I think, and people are really mobilized on it. But, you know, if you look at it from a security point of view, you say, wouldn't we like to be importing more oil from, say, Canada and less oil from, say, volatile parts of the Middle East?
Isn't it dirtier oil, though? I mean, in the sense of the process it has to go through?
Well, that's what I was alluding to. It's six, yeah. You know, if you look at the whole chain of it, it's 6% more carbon. It's not these numbers, because most of the carbon is the result of what comes out of your tailpipe of your car, the combustion process that goes there. And if you look at the footprint, it's a very small footprint in a very large province that's the size of Canada. But a lot of these factors, you know, there's no question it has to be managed in an environmentally sound way. And the Canadians, you know, it's their country. They're pretty careful about it. And it has to be rigorously applied. And the other thing, it goes back to what you said about technology. The technology is focused on reducing the carbon footprint of it. But if that oil doesn't come to the United States, a lot of it does. Canada is our largest source of oil imports today. If the oil sands was an independent country, it would be the largest source of oil for our country. But if the additional supply doesn't come here, then it will go to China.
Talking with Daniel Yergin, China may, within about 20 years or so, maybe even less, be, well, more reliant on oil than we are.
Well, that's right. It is it was striking. When I look back at the prize, I realize I hardly mentioned China. China was an oil exporter at that time. Today, China is the only country in the quest that gets two chapters of its own. And it's because I think it's so important that readers understand the dynamic for exactly the reason you're saying, that China is becoming such a preponderant factor in world energy markets. And it's an important issue between the United States and China in the whole geopolitics of the relationship, kind of to understand where they're coming from and how they and what their needs are. And you're quite right. By the end of this decade, China could actually be consuming more oil than the United States. It already consumes more energy total than the United States.
Again, our guest Daniel Yergin and his new book, The Quest, Energy Security and the Remaking of the Modern World. He's the author of The Prize, which won the Pulitzer Prize. Prize that won the prize. So let's talk about fracking, because you're on the Department of Energy committee that's investigating the environmental impact of fracking. And again, there's a great deal of concern, emotional concern about fracking.
Yeah, exactly. And our committee on March 31st, President Obama assigned us to come back. What he said is that this is a tremendous resource, 100 years of supply, but it has to be done environmentally right. Come back and tell us what needs to be done. So we had our subcommittee worked on this, a number of distinguished scientists on it, and came back with about 20 points that we thought need to be addressed. I don't know if we need to explain fracking to your listeners or whether they already know.
It's getting natural gas out of the ground from shale, but right. The concerns are just to kind of break it down and be succinct in terms of the environmental are largely air pollution and the drilling that we get methane into the groundwater.
Right. Well, I think that in each case that the air pollution, we said there are three issues that really need to be managed. One is water. And not so much the fracking itself is highly, the scientists say it's highly unlikely to affect the water supply. What is the problem is how you manage the water that's produced that comes out of the ground. And it's an industrial process. And it has to either be disposed of properly or it has to be treated properly. And this has grown very fast. I mean, 30% of our natural gas production in the country now is shale gas, and it's headed upward. The second thing is the thing you talk about, air pollution. And that didn't get so much attention a year and a half ago. And we came away saying this is something that really needs attention. And you just have to manage the emissions just like you manage emissions in California and automobiles and industrial processes.
Is it from the equipment and the generators?
Yeah, it's all these diesel machines. Exactly. And the trucks. And that's the third issue is that, you know, some parts of the country are used to oil and gas development. Pennsylvania That's where the oil industry started with Colonel Drake, but that was a long time ago. And so you start to have a lot of trucks going through small communities. It damages the roads. It affects people, say, what's happening to our community. So I think we also said community impact needs to be addressed, and communities have to be engaged in discussions to talk about. You can't just suddenly have somebody show up and start drilling. It has to be part of a discussion with the local community. So those, we submitted our report in August, focused on best practices, technical excellence, improving knowledge. And the position that we took is if this type of program is put into effect and proper regulation, transparency and disclosure, then we can continue to benefit from this resource, which is brought down the cost of electricity substantially in some parts of the country and has also created hundreds of thousands of jobs.
Bottom line, one comes away from reading your book, is we're always going to be dependent on energy.
Yeah, until
kingdom come.
Yeah.
But not necessarily oil.
Right. I mean, it's a transition. I mean, we have a $14 trillion economy, and it rests on this energy, pretty complex energy foundation that's been built up for a long period of time. There's change in motion, and one of the things I talk about in the book, it's almost this straight line from the smog of Southern California in the late 40s and early 50s to the California Air Resources Board, which is a sort of almost the global regulator of the automobile industry, to the return of the electric car, which was thought to be dead for a century, ever since Henry Ford came out with his Model T.
Well, actually, going back in your work to 1979, you were talking about, you co-authored a book called Energy Future, and you were talking about the importance of solar back then. Renewables are getting a lot of attention, particularly from those who are fed up with fossil fuel and who feel that, you know, we've come to the end of the line here. We really need to look to renewables entirely. In the wake of what happened with Solyndra, there's sort of a couple of steps backward in many people's minds. I think what you're advocating, if I don't want to be speaking for you here, but is, yeah, we need renewables, but we need to be as diversified as we can.
Yeah, I think I'd start with we need a diversified portfolio of energy sources. No one is smart enough to really know what the future is going to be, and you just can't bank on any one silver bullet. And I always go back. I found
not even hydrogen, like Jeremy Rifkin says?
Maybe down the road. I always go back to Winston Churchill, when he was first Lord of the Admiralty on the eve of the First World War, made this decision to convert the British Navy from coal to oil to gain speed over the German Navy and flexibility. And people said to him, my gosh, what are you going to do? You're going to give up using Welsh coal and you're going to depend upon this country we were talking about before, Iran. That's going to be your source of oil. And Churchill said, safety in oil lie in variety and variety alone. And I believe in energy today, we should say, safety and energy is in variety and diversification. I think renewables, it's funny, California plays a big role in this book in a number of different ways. One of it is in the birth of renewables, and then what I call in the book the rebirth of renewables, because of course the 70s, 80s, California was where most of the wind business really got going. And then the renewable business went, as some of your listeners will know very well, into what people called the Valley of Death. It was oil prices were low, lost attention. Then around 2000, it comes back. And today the renewable industry is a much more sophisticated industry, technologically sophisticated than it was then. A wind turbine today is not the same machine as one in the 1980s. And solar, certainly the imperative is to drive down the cost of solar to make it competitive.
You seem to have a good deal of faith in conservation as a real possibility.
Yes, I think, you mentioned that book, did Energy Future. And when I published that book, our team published it at Harvard Business School. It ended up on the front page of the New York Times because it had a very bizarre statement. And the bizarre statement is that perhaps the most important near-term energy source that we have is efficiency or conservation. And people thought this was really weird coming from the Harvard Business School. But I look back on what we said and I see that we were not too optimistic. We were much too cautious. The U.S. is twice as energy efficient today as it was in the 1970s. A great deal has been achieved. The problem with conservation is there's no photo op. And as I quote former Energy Commissioner of the European Union, who said the problem with energy efficiency is there's no red ribbon to cut. You can't have a ceremony. But I think it's profoundly important. And, you know, I would say if we had a national goal, one of our goals ought to be to double our energy efficiency again. And we're going to do it in a way. We go from cars that get 30 miles to the gallon to cars that get 54 miles to the gallon. That's like a huge oil field. When I was driving over here, I saw a billboard for a diesel car, 43 miles to the gallon. I thought, well, we're getting there.
What were you driving over in?
I was just driving over in a Honda.
Well, you mentioned Fukushima before, and when you think about that or Deepwater Horizon and the leaks, the catastrophes really that have occurred, kind of sets a lot of the whole notion of how we can control energy and particularly petroleum into another sphere, doesn't it?
I think both accidents are accidents that should not have happened and people thought couldn't happen. And deeply sobering. And I think in retrospect that the deep water was progressed on the basis you couldn't have an accident and the technology really got ahead of the ability to deal with accidents or things going wrong. And I think people are still assimilating the lessons that deep water is one of the frontiers. And I think that a lot of attitudes towards fracking and other things were actually affected by the Macondo accident because it's, you know, an accident that couldn't happen.
I think Fukushima's affected the whole view of nuclear energy.
Oh, it's changed. If we'd been talking on March 10th, which would have been a Thursday, we would have been talking about the possibility of a nuclear renaissance because that's what people were talking about around the world. And Chancellor Merkel of Germany was one of the leaders of it. A week later, she was saying nuclear has to stop in Germany. And it is, again, I saw a quote from a man who had run the Fukushima plant in the 1990s, and he said, the notion of a tsunami never crossed my mind. We never thought about it. And, you know, again, the lesson is about the need to think the unthinkable and have institutions and organizations that can adapt. And
but these are like 9/11. You don't think of these things. Somehow. They're not in the scenarios that we build up, and they show us just how vulnerable we are.
Yeah, that's right. 9/11 comes, and we could say, well, how could we not know that what's happening here were all these clues and they weren't put together? But I remember reading a book, a three-volume history of Pearl Harbor, and this great historian, Gordon Prang, said the most important reason that Pearl Harbor happened is because people thought it could never happen.
Talking again with Daniel Yergin, and his new book is The Quest, Energy Security and the Remaking of the Modern World. He'll be at the Commonwealth Club today at 6 p.m., later this evening, I should say. And we're also we'll be at the Hillside Club in Berkeley tomorrow at 7:30 p.m. You're often described as an insider, an analyst for energy corporations and for, well, international, multinational corporations and so forth. Does that get in the way? To what extent does it get in the way?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, what we do is we basically write research on what we think is happening in energy markets around the world, energy developments, energy technologies, and it includes oil and gas. We also have emerging energy research, which focuses on renewables and new technologies. And our job is, you know, we live and die on the quality of the research. People subscribe to it, and if it's not appropriate quality, then we're in trouble. So we have to have these very strict standards about objectivity and independence.
We're going to invite those of you listening to join us. If you have questions or comments for Daniel Yergin, we welcome your calls. We're talking about energy and the future of energy. His new book is The Quest, Energy Security and the Remaking of the Modern World. And it has a lot to do, obviously, with geopolitics and the whole history of energy as it's evolved. As I said earlier, we welcome your calls, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. You can join our program now, 866-733-6786. Your questions and comments are welcome. Again, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also send an email to forum@kqed.org. Or post a question or comment on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And, of course, you can also join us by going to our Facebook page. When we return, we'll hear from you. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest is Daniel Yergin, and his new book is called The Quest, Energy, Security, and the Remaking of the World. He'll be at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco tonight at 6 p.m. and also at the Hillside Club in Berkeley tomorrow at 7:30 p.m. Daniel, I have to tell you, I'm looking at the new Harper's Index. Just got my brand new copy of Harper's. And, you know, they have all these figures and that sometimes make your eyebrows raise up. As I was going through the new Harper's Index, I came across this and just want to get your response to this. Estimated value of government subsidies that will go to the oil and gas industries between now and 2015, $78,155,000,000. That sounds – it is astronomical. But to many people, it sounds ludicrous, of course, too.
Yeah. Well, it depends, of course, how you define subsidies. And I was reading a report on subsidies to the oil and gas industry that's had the largest single segment was what they said was what's called a foreign tax credit. So I was interested. I thought – I wasn't sure the logic was right. I looked at the footnote, it only had one footnote reference, which happened to be a book called The Prize that I wrote. And the argument in The Prize was just the opposite. So there are clearly subsidies, but I think and that some of them are maybe large, but you have to – definition really matters. I don't think the foreign tax credit's a subsidy. Another one that's given is the tax credit for manufacturing, but, you know, the New York Times gets that subsidy too. So it all depends on definition. And I think that the point of why some of this is there is that there's no question that we need to bring and nurture the renewable energy industry so it becomes an increasingly important part of our energy supply. I'm not sure you need that other argument to do it.
Well, speaking about statistics just for a moment, we were talking about the, quote, flap about peak oil, and the reserve figures are often inflated, and it's very difficult to estimate what's in reserve, isn't it?
It is, particularly for other countries. In the U.S., reserve numbers are very tightly regulated by the Securities and Exchange Commission, and if they get fudged, people are in hot water and end up paying fines and other things. In other parts of the world, it's much looser, particularly where you have national oil companies. But so people also make their assessments on what the ultimate recoverable reserve is, not on kind of the reported what goes to the Securities and Exchange Commission, but basically on estimates of the geology. And now that, for instance, shale gas, and also you have shale oil, which is big growing in the U.S., suddenly resources that were not counted before are now counted.
The new book is The Quest, Energy, Security, and the Remaking of the Modern World. He's also the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Prize, which is also a novel by Irving Wallace.
Yes, exactly. And sometimes I would find, you know, I'd go into a bookstore and look for The Prize, and I would find it was filed in fiction. And But it turns out that that my title was actually a phrase from Churchill, the prize of the venture, why he converted the Royal Navy from coal to oil. And it was about geopolitics and what he called world mastery. But prize of the venture was hard to say, so I shortened it to the prize and then suddenly remembered Irving Wallace.
He didn't have necessarily a patent on it or an intellectual hold on it. Yeah. I also should remind listeners that Daniel Yergin's The Prize was made into a PBS special as well as a BBC special, which had quite a run. In fact.
Yes.
Let's go to your calls. We'll go to Menlo Park first. Robert, you're on the air.
Hi, I'd like to ask Daniel a question. He, in 2005, said that oil would grow, production of oil would grow at 3% a year, and now this year he's saying it's going to grow at 0.3% a year, which really is just because of biofuels and natural gas liquids. So I contend that he is actually supporting the fact that we've plateaued production of liquid oil, conventional liquid oil, and it's not going back. And I think it's a national imperative that we have to get off the oil as fast as possible because of the environmental impact and also supporting regimes like Saudi Arabia. We need to go faster in terms of getting off oil, and the alternatives such as shale are woefully inadequate in terms of depletion rates and probably not competitive with things like wind and solar if you actually look at the economics.
Daniel Juergen.
Well, first of all, on the competitive thing, I was just talking yesterday to somebody who's in the wind business, a very successful entrepreneur, and he said the problem is that shale gas is so competitive that it's making the economics of wind more difficult. So I don't think I agree with that point. Secondly, I don't know what he's talking about when he says, I said 0.3%. I don't know where those numbers are coming from.
You know the source of that, caller? Or do you remember the source of it?
Yeah, it was he said 20 years, it would grow at 20% over 20 years in 2005.
Well, I think if we're talking about world oil, I mean, we would use that was 100, yeah, we expect about 20% growth. That includes things like tight oil. It includes things like the pre-salt off of Brazil, which is that large resource. It includes oil sands. It includes the new huge new discoveries off French Guiana in Latin America. We can go down the list. So I think if you look at what's happening with U.S. oil production is actually up 10% since 2008. I mean, we can go back and forth in these numbers, but that's the Department of Energy number, that it's up 10% since 2008. But it's not to say that this is all a hayride, that it's all easy, that there's a lot of challenges. And I think the listener does point out that costs are certainly some of these are higher cost resources, and the whole cost base of oil has gone up.
And let me thank the listener and go to more of your calls. We'll go to Sebastopol. Dave, join us. You're on.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. The question I had was, there's been quite a bit of concern about the amount of fossil fuel that could be consumed to protect that would have a bad effect on the climate. And the question I had was, given the amount of renewables that actually have to be constructed, do you think that there's a possibility that we will have enough fossil fuel to actually build the amount of renewables that are required to protect the climate?
Well, I think that I think it's a question of timing, that we have the energy system is big and complex. It doesn't turn over overnight. I mean, 30 miles per gallon is what a new car gets today. 2025, it should be 54 miles per gallon. You can't do that overnight. It takes time to make these changes. So when I look out, it seems that our energy system will see more renewables, we'll see a lot of growth, we'll see the impact of China. But the big changes in our energy system will probably come more likely after 2030 than before it, just because of the long lead times.
I thank the caller. More of your calls in a moment. Let me go to some emails, though, and some web remarks. You thought that, we both thought there'd be a lot of response to your comments about peak oil or
You brought up the subject.
Yes, I did. I brought up fracking, too. I thought there'd be but here's the response. The responses are coming in more on the pipeline. Here's Andrew, who says, I'm disappointed to hear that your guest endorses the pipeline. The tar sands aren't about how much carbon is produced or isn't produced. The tar sands symbolize a choice in where we draw the line of extracting energy. To what lengths will we need to feed our energy needs? Will we take a gamble and invest in a pipeline that feeds incredibly dirty oil through the middle of a continent risking environmental destruction? Or will we take a gamble and invest in clean, renewable energy? And another listener writes, this is Susan, I agree that it's important to use oil sources other than the Middle East, so oil from Canada seems like a good idea. But the bottom line for protesters of the pipeline is that continuing to build huge, expensive oil pipelines takes away from the effort towards alternative fuels and lessening our dependence on oil.
Well, I think both of them demonstrate that really the debate about the pipeline is not about the pipeline. It's a vision of the world, and that somehow if this pipeline is stopped, we can all go into some other world that will be a much greener and more attractive world. I don't think actually the two are mutually exclusive, because frankly, if the pipeline's not built, we'll import the oil from Nigeria and Angola and from the Middle East and from other countries, because Americans aren't going to give up their cars tomorrow. I mean, we can go ahead and progress, and I very strongly support it, towards much more efficient automobiles. But we still, to the time being, people are going to still go around in automobiles. And so it's not like you're going to, and the oil will simply go somewhere else. But it is so interesting that it is really, when you realize it and you're listening to those comments, you realize it's not about the pipeline. It's much more symbolic of a much larger question.
Well, where priorities ought to be, yeah. I think, is what they're saying. There's another listener who says, does Mr. Juergen think there is a real potential to convert truck engines to run on natural gas, or is this just a fantasy of T. Boone Pickens?
That's one thing that's out there because of the abundance of natural gas, and you can convert the trucks. I think it's not clear that it's on large scale makes economic sense to do it because of you lose cargo space and so forth. But I'd say it's one of those things that will, if prices remain low of natural gas, and the spread between oil and gas is so large, then we'll see more people at least experimenting with it.
You mentioned Angela Merkel before, and Germany is now about 20% alternative energy, I believe, or right around that figure. In fact, we had Jeremy Rifkin on, and he's been advising her and advising the EU, and he claims that we can not only move to those kind of numbers, but we can become get all buildings essentially energy efficient, not only new buildings, but buildings that already exist, and move to self-sufficiency off of the grids, off of the computer grids with energy. I mean, does that sound utopian to you?
It sounds utopian to me. I mean, I think I look at the nature of our system and where we're investing in resources. I mean, again, perhaps after 2030 or 2040, it will look different. It's interesting. Germany's, you know, their big bet now is that they can develop a very vigorous offshore wind industry, and that's the kind of frontier.
They're putting a lot of marbles in there.
Yeah, exactly. What they're going to do to replace their nuclear power, they're going to do three things. They're going to import more natural gas from Russia to make electricity. They're going to import nuclear-generated electricity from France, which is France is one of its biggest exports, and they're going to really make that big bet on offshore wind, and that's a very important technological frontier.
Speaking about wind, you got a whole story about California and wind in your book. Can you give us a synopsis? I think it would be interesting to listeners to hear.
Yeah, it was very interesting to me because I was yesterday down in Santa Barbara and I met the man who I wrote about, a man named Jim Delson, who in 1981 was in the Tehachapi Pass in a blizzard on top of a turbine trying to get his wind turbine up by midnight so he could get the tax credits before they expired. And he said, there has to be a better way to do this. And he went to Europe, eventually hooked up with some Danish people who'd come out of the Danish agricultural machinery business and saw that they had much sturdier wind turbines. He started importing them, and Denmark became the main source of California's first generation of wind turbines. And that really is the birth of the birth of the modern wind industry is in California. And you really say it was a marriage between sturdy Danish agricultural machinery and California tax policy.
On we go to more of your calls. We go to Napa. Jay, you're on.
Yes, good morning, Michael and Daniel. Daniel, I'd like to get your opinion about the cap and trade method of developing alternative energy. And also, if you think there's any chance that we'll ever implement a cap-and-trade system in the United States.
Right. I got interested in this whole question of where did climate change come from as a policy issue, and went back and found myself starting in the Alps in the 1770s. But one part of it, I was going to write one chapter on it. I ended up writing six chapters. But one is I got very interested in cap and trade and using market systems to get environmental progress. And the cap and trade was a great invention, really, in the 80s and the 90s, and it really helped us clean up our coal plants much more quickly than people thought would be possible, and much more cheaply, by giving market signals and not saying you do this, you do that, but letting people try different paths. I think what we saw in 2009 of trying to put together Waxman-Markey, and there's a picture and a long interview with Congressman Markey in the book, is that it's very difficult to create a system like that for a whole economy as complex as ours. And you have to do so many trade-offs that it becomes very unwieldy. So I think that and doing it when we're in a recession was really just not on. So I think it depends on – I think there was a political moment when it looked like there was a consensus for it. It seems to me that it's receded for the time being, and that the way climate policy will more likely be implemented is through things like California saying one-third of your electricity has to be renewable, or through fuel efficiency standards, rather than trying to create a kind of new market system as reasonable as it seems theoretically, but I think it just became so complex.
I want to thank the caller. Go to a web comment. Listener writes, Mr. Yergin is misrepresenting what the peak oil movement is saying. They aren't saying we are going to run out of oil tomorrow. They are saying we are halfway through world supplies and we are running out of cheap oil. Oil can only be found in very hard-to-reach expensive places or dangerous political places. Our economy depends on cheap oil. Once price per gallon gets into the $5 a gallon range, been stuck at $5 in California for quite a while now, our economic growth model no longer makes sense.
Well, I think it's just there is a difference in the analysis. I think the analysis we would have is that we're about 20% through the oil resource, not 50% through it. And I don't, you know, I think that what you said is not terribly different. I mean, I certainly see that that we are in a higher cost era for oil, not only because the oil is more expensive, but because all the inputs that go into it, like steel and copper and all these other things, are also more expensive. And so much of it actually goes back to what happened in 2004, which is really the explosion of growth in China for and its appetite for commodities of all kinds, which has become such a driving factor in the world economy.
A listener named Russell writes, whether or not there is a constituency for nuclear power, planners will have to concede there is no settled science where the water is going to be coming from to operate nukes, ditto coal. In coming decades, we face climate dynamics which mean nothing if they do not address unreliability of rivers, glacial runoff, estuaries, tides.
Well, that's a big mega point. Obviously, nuclear power plants need a lot of water for cooling. Coal does. And water is something that is now much more talked about in connection with energy than it was in the past. We did a paper a couple of years ago on water and energy, and what you tend to see is that the water issues are kind of local and regional. It depends on where you are and what part of the country or what part of the world.
I got a web comment that says, regarding the tar sands, Canada does not have any sort of energy policy or environmental safety standards that account for the costs incurred by Canada and the planet in strip mining massive areas of the boreal forest for bitumen. The degradation of entire watersheds and the leaching of carcinogens in the environment are but two of the problems that have long been identified by local citizens and Canadians at large.
Well, I'd just like to read you one sentence from the Quest. To date, the entire footprint from mining oil sands is an area that adds up to about 230 square miles of land in a province of Alberta that is about the size of Texas. So I think it's important to keep proportion in mind in talking about it. And this kind of language gets used as though an entire landscape is being turned into the backside of the moon, and you have to keep the scale in mind with it. It is an industrial process, but 230 square miles in an area the size of Texas, I think we could find things in the United States that would also be that size.
I think the fear is, I'm probably speaking for a lot of people because, you know, I've been doing this program for many years,
right,
and I've heard this, when they talked about clear cutting, for example, and they started off smaller and then it grew, and now you look at areas which are just completely clear cut.
Yeah. Well, that's why I said, but if you say how big is it, it's 230 square miles.
No, but the fear is that it's going to grow exponentially.
Yeah.
You know?
Now, the Canadians also needs to be, they're still in early stages, is kind of the restoration of the landscape as well. That's part of the, and that's part of actually the cost of developing it. So it's, you know, it definitely has an environmental footprint. Is it the kind of cataclysmic that we hear from some of the listeners? I don't think so.
I think we're on point here with you, Kim. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thank you so much for the program. An earlier comment sort of addressed what I'm going to ask you. I was watching Washington Journal the other morning, and someone from a petroleum institute and real pretty gal was talking about all the high sides, and obviously employment is one of them for the pipeline. And she made reference more than once about how it was going to reduce fuel costs to Americans. And I really would love to have you straight-facedly say if that's at all true, because I don't feel, and again, I don't have any facts to back it up, but I don't feel we're ever going to go down in our cost per gallon in this country. I think we can only look forward to higher and higher fuel costs throughout the rest of my lifetime.
Well, I think kind of let me divide that into two parts. I think that we do see a higher cost basis. And that goes to what I talk about in the Quest, this globalization of demand, and which, Michael, you talked about at the beginning of the show, that China's going to be using more oil than we are. So you have a And China last year sold 17 million new cars, the U.S. 11 million cars. People talk about 30 million cars. So the demand is there. And it's a huge – it's one of the three big challenges in the book. One is energy for a growing world. Two, energy security. And three, the question we're talking, how do you match up energy objectives with environmental objectives? On the pipeline, I think it's just – it's kind of basic economics. If you have more supply and you have more flexibility in your supply system, that tends to mean that prices are relatively lower than they would be if you have a more rigid supply system and supplies don't move around as easily, then you'll have higher prices. But your basic point, can we go back to the kind of low prices that people remember from, a decade or two ago? 1998, actually, gasoline prices, when you adjusted for inflation, were lower than they'd ever been in the United States. And that, of course, was the high point of selling of SUVs. Can we go back to that, based upon where we are today? Probably not. But we can certainly have relatively lower prices. And relatively lower prices are good for consumers, and it's good for our economy.
Although, as we said earlier, if the Saudis decide to use competition against Iran and lower the oil price
exactly.
in response to this latest thing.
Or the other thing is we did see low oil prices in December of 2008, but it was for a terrible reason. It was because we were going into the worst recession since the Great Depression.
Here's a listener who says, just a minimal and passing reference to global warming by your guest. Many believe it is perhaps the most serious problem facing humanity. Dr. James Hansen believes that we are nearing the point where it may become irreversible. Actually, James Hansen was on this program and said, I think that we are there already. He was actually advocating nuclear energy. How serious of a problem does Mr. Juergen believe climate change is? And we should mention there's a whole section about Roger Revelle in Daniel Juergen's book, the man who actually educated Al Gore at Harvard about global warming.
Well, exactly. To say passing reference, I'd say six chapters.
Well, he meant on the show here.
Oh, I see. Okay. As opposed to in the book. Yeah. No, the story I wanted to tell about climate change, because you have Jim Hansen, you have Al Gore, people expressing the view. What I wanted to do was, again, so much of this book is how did things happen? How did it come about? How did something that a few scientists worried about become this mega issue? And Roger Revelle at the Scripps Oceanographic Institute, it's another I was just thinking as I was out here on the West Coast how much of the key things in this book are California-oriented, because it was a scientist who he brought Keeling that he brought to Scripps, who came up to Big Sur, tried to measure carbon, couldn't because the vegetation threw it off. And that really Scripps was probably the kind, if you're looking for the intellectual ferment that stimulated a lot of the climate science, it goes back there and goes back to this very forceful personality named Roger Revelle.
How do you come down, though, on climate change?
Well, I think it's clear that the carbon is going up, substantially, and that will have impact on climate. I leave it to the scientists to say how soon and what the range of uncertainty is. But the way I deal with it in the book is that this is a very serious question, and we have to see how it formulated. How did it go from science to this famous hearing where James Hansen, I have a picture of him at that hearing in 1988 when it kind of burst on the political scene on the hottest day of the year in a highly televised Senate hearing.
We have a caller on from Fort McMurray, Alberta, up in Canada. Phil, join us.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to make a comment about, about the oil sands themselves. I mean, most of the land that's being mined at the moment gets put back right to its natural state right after the fact. And the employment up here, it employs pretty well the whole province. I mean, they're going to need anywhere from 50,000 to 130,000 more workers in the next 8 years. And, I think it's getting totally overblown, the negative impacts that are being done around here.
Okay, Phil. Good to hear from you. Yeah. I thank you for that call. We'll go to another caller, and that's you. Chuck, join us.
Yes, Michael and Mr. Juergen, two points. Or two questions, I guess. I wonder if you might comment on the Bakken oil formation in the Dakotas in Montana, and also, to what extent that's going to expand the years that we will have a domestic oil supply. And then secondly, perhaps comment on whether or not there have been any significant developments in carbon sequestration of coal energy that would make that cleaner and a more feasible source of energy in the future.
Well, first on the Bakken, that's an area in a formation in North Dakota, and it is kind of one of the biggest energy stories in the United States. One doesn't think of North Dakota as part of the oil patch, but it's now the fourth largest oil producing state in the country, and some think it will overtake the third largest, which happens to be California, actually. And it's exactly, you know, it is technology opening doors that seem to be closed using techniques of shale gas. And that's why we're having growth in our domestic oil production. And the rest of the world is looking at it with very great interest. So we're seeing, you know, North Dakota is a state with virtually no unemployment, by the way, but it is, you know, it's resource driven. So that is what that's about, and other parts of the country as well. And it's kind of changed the view of prospects for the U.S. going back to our peak oil discussion. Carbon sequestration is a notion of capturing the carbon one way or the other that's produced with burning coal. And a lot of discussion, but I think that there's a lack of is demonstrating that you can do this on a large scale. So it's still something in the future. It's one way that would keep coal in business. It's thought to be expensive, involves a lot of heavy engineering. You would take it, you would capture the coal, you would the CO2, and you would compress it and then bury it in the earth. A lot to be demonstrated there. So it's kind of on the agenda. Research is going into it, but it's still very early days.
It's in an embryonic phase, isn't it, at this point? Daniel Juergen's new book is The Prize. His new book is The Quest. The former book that won the Pulitzer Prize was The Prize. The Quest, Energy Security and the Remaking of the Modern World. And it's really a look at the recent history of the energy industry and emerging renewable technologies and the notion of peak oil. And well, it takes on an enormous amount of what I know interests many of you. And he'll be at the Commonwealth Club later today at 6 p.m. and tomorrow at the Hillside Club in Berkeley at 7:30 p.m. So good to have you with us.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you for being here. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Remind you that you can continue this conversation on our website. Simply be going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment, or go to our Facebook page. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. You can also let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by calling our listener call-in response line at 415-553-3300. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg, and our interns, Adam Sisenick, Dominic Tan, Don Clyde, Molly Williams, Jameson Katsoufas, and Preeti Shakir. And our engineer is Danny Bringer. Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.